My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Skip Horak. Skip, welcome to Portland.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Okay, and welcome to KBOO, I guess, also. But you know Portland a little bit. You kind of like it here, huh?
A little bit. I love it here. I've been here two or three times before, and it's just it's fantastic. I'm from the South originally, so I like seeing all the greenery.
Oh, so you're from Georgia? Or
Louisiana.
Louisiana,
actually.
That's right. Yeah. So somebody's from Georgia in this book. I know that.
Yeah.
Skip Horak was born May 24th. I was born May 22nd, so I consider you like a brother. In Covington, Louisiana, and you attended St. Paul's School. You're a Jones lecturer at Stanford, or that used to be a Jones, or you still are?
I still am.
Good. Short story collection, The Southern Cross, won the Bakeless Prize. You're a former Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford, BA in English, and you're a JD. You're a lawyer.
I was a lawyer at one time, a reform lawyer.
A recovering lawyer, yeah. You worked for 5 years in Baton Rouge as a lawyer, and then you decided you're going to be a writer and a teacher. Good for you. We're here to talk about your latest novel, The Eden Hunter, and your last name is spelled Horak, H-O-R-A-C-K, and it's published by Counterpoint Press. This is what they used to call a picaresque, I guess, back in the old days. It follows someone on a series of adventures, kind of episodes in the person's life. But in this case, this is not your normal protagonist that we're used to seeing. His name is Kau, is that pronounced?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, yeah. And he's an Ota pygmy from Africa who was swept up and became a slave. I'm going to ask you a little bit about that. But first, for most novels, it's fairly obvious from the subject matter what interested the author about the subject matter, or why the author decided to write a novel about that. In this case, it's so unusual, I guess, for want of a better word. You had to learn about pygmies. You had to learn about the American South in 1816 or thereabouts, before there really was a complete United States in the southern part of the what's now the United States. What first attracted you to this material?
Yeah, guys, it's a combination of things, I suppose. But I guess what came first is I spent some time, about 5 years of my life living in northern Florida. And while I was living there, I came upon the story of this fort that the British had built in the panhandle there during the War of 1812. And at the time, this was sort of a no man's land. It was Spanish in name, but a wilderness, really. And the British built this fort with the intention of recruiting runaway American slaves that were living in the area to join, enlist with them in the fight against the Americans. And they're actually quite successful in this, but before the fort ever saw battle, the war ended. And so these British officers, they sailed back to England and told the runaway slaves that were in the fort to, hold the fort.
Hold the fort.
We'll
yes.
be back, you yeah. know. And I think they actually perhaps intended that, because the war ended with sort of a treaty that was a ceasefire type thing. But when they went back to England, I think England was done fighting wars in America at that point. And so they never came back. And you had this situation for about a year and a half. You had a fort just across the border from Georgia that was completely manned by runaway American and Spanish slaves, as well as some Native Americans seeking sort of shelter there. And so and it was continuing to serve as a beacon for slaves in the plantations in Georgia. They would hear about it, and they would make a bid for, to cross into Spanish Florida and seek refuge there. And that became a real thorn in the side for American plantation owners, and they were eventually able to convince the American government to do something about it. And so I won't go into really what happened next, because that's maybe a big part of the novel. But that's the original source story that I stumbled upon, and I became really fascinated with it and researched it more as a hobby than anything else. But I'm a writer as well, and eventually I started to think, well, this might be something that I would like to try and tackle or treat with a novel. But then the question became, okay, well, how to tell it? And somewhere along the line, I became fascinated with the idea of telling it from the point of view of a African pygmy who winds up in America as a slave and runs away and eventually makes it to this fort. Probably what gave me that idea is I came across the biography of a African pygmy named Ota Benga, who in the early 1900s was purchased from Arab slave traders and brought to America. He was sort of liberated from Arab slave traders and brought to America, but wasn't treated much better here. That story fascinated me as well. And I think I like the idea of combining those two stories because I was looking at my own writing, the short stories and things that I'd been working on, and I found that, you know, pretty much everything that I wrote had something to do with nature and man's relationship with nature. And that area, that part of the country really captures my imagination, you know, the American South, the pine woods and bayous and river bottom areas. And so perhaps no group of people has ever lived in closer harmony with nature than these pygmy tribes of Central Africa. And I became really fascinated with the idea of taking such a person and dropping him into a landscape that I knew well. And so in a way, there's a lot of violence in the book, but it's, I've always kind of seen it as a love letter to this nature and this part of, you know, this terrain and landscape that I grew up in and really admire. So those three things, I guess, came together and led to the book.
Yeah, back in the distant past when I was studying anthropology, the Ituri pygmies were fascinating to me because they're surrounded by, I guess Bantu was the major tribe or major group, cultural and genetic group around them. And the Bantu treat them miserably. They enslave them, they exploit them, they kill them, they rape them, all because they're bigger and they can do it. And so the Ituri pygmy has had to devise a way not only to live with you have a group here called the Kesa. Is that a real?
It's not. I actually made it to the Ituri forest and spent some time there. And in the end, I decided to fictionalize the tribe that my protagonist comes from, as well as the sort of majority tribe that his people are kind of subservient to. They do have this symbiotic relationship where the pygmy tribes will supply the protein and the honey, and the Bantus will supply vegetables and fruit and things like that. But it's symbiotic in that sense. It's not equal, like mm-hmm. you're saying.
It's exploited more than anything.
Right.
And the pygmies have had to figure out not just how to deal with the Bantu to live with them, you know, in the best way possible, but also in some ways to get around them, to outsmart them a little bit. They've devised a method which suits Kau very well when he comes to the United States and it becomes a slave in an inn. Mm-hmm. He's sold to an innkeeper, and he decides that he needs to get the hell out of there and find Eden, to find some place. And oddly enough, the slave name he has is Adam.
Right.
So did you cleverly figure that out?
Yeah.
Tell us about the innkeeper and his son Benjamin, and what is Kau doing there?
Well, you know, it was all fine and dandy to decide I wanted my protagonist to be an African pygmy, but then I had to have him. For me to write the novel, I felt like he needed to have a handle of English and the language and be able to move around a little bit. And so the prologue of the book kind of covers his birth in Africa, his capture by slave traders, passage in the boat to America, and then eventually brought from the port in Pensacola up into Georgia, what was the Mississippi Territory then, present day Alabama. And yeah, and so I sort of noticed in all of their history, the pygmies have been treated as curiosities. You know, there's even in pyramids in Egypt hieroglyphs where the pharaohs are asking traders to bring them these dancers from the from the Congo area. So in researching these tribes, I became interested in the idea of him being held at an inn as sort of a curiosity, and eventually having this friendship with the child of the innkeeper, sort of a play a little bit on the Huckleberry Finn paradigm. This one turns out a little bit differently, but
alas, it does. There's also another slave there named Samuel. There's a lot of biblical names in this thing. Samuel is an African slave, not a pygmy, but mm-hmm. and what's his story? How long is he? Is he the son of slaves? Is he?
Tell us
about him.
Yes, he's an elderly slave who is already at the inn. He's the only other slave there, and he is the son of slaves and somebody who has been completely born into slavery. Has never known any type of freedom, but he also serves as something of a tutor to Kau in the 5 years that he himself is enslaved, and, you know, helps him with the languages and things like that, and got my protagonist to a point where when the book opens, he has, you know, the tools at his disposal to make a run for it. As you were talking about, in Africa, the pygmies, they sort of agree, they don't mind being looked down upon because they're sort of playing a long con with the Bantus, in the sense that they're getting what they want, and when they're away from them in the forest, they mock them and do everything else. But when
it's
they're around,
it's called shucking
them,
and jiving in this country. Yes,
right, exactly, to a certain extent. And so there's a little bit of that going on, and in that way, Samuel serves as a mentor to him.
Now, what was going on in the fledgling United States in 1816? First of all, it wasn't much more than the original 13 colonies. It wasn't too long since they had fought the war with the British for independence, and then came the War of 1812, during which Washington, D.C. was burned. They were in rough shape, and then in 1814 or so, there was an Indian uprising. The Creek Indians decided that they decided that they weren't going to give the Americans some grief as well. Give us a little bit of a picture of what was going on.
Yeah, that's at that time, you know, Georgia and South Carolina were states. All of Florida belonged to the Spanish as a territory, but they basically had no presence there other than Pensacola, you know, and in some of the other coastal cities. And so that was kind of a no man's land. And what is now Alabama and Mississippi was one big area called the Mississippi Territory. And a portion of that, the Creek Indians, about, you know, around the same time as the War of 1812, had their own civil war between the two of them, between a faction of the Creeks who wanted to break away from the influence of the white man and go back to return to traditional ways, and the other, probably the majority of the Creeks who wanted to, you know, adopt and ally with these invaders, right? So in that civil war, the faction, of course, that was backed by the Europeans and the Americans won, and these Red Stick Creeks, who were the ones who wanted to return to the traditional ways, found themselves sort of chased, a lot of them chased into Florida. And so that, you know, the Seminole tribe was not a tribe when Columbus arrived in America. They were comprised of Indians who had, you know, fled from, you know, tribes that had been destroyed and Indians that had fled for whatever reason into this no man's land. So that's part of what was going on. And then in the country itself, yeah, the war was, it was a busy time. I mean, that's why some of these stories, I think, were lost to history as far as what happened with this war. And it was certainly not a story that I'd ever heard of before.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Skip Horak. The title of his book is The Eden Hunter, and it's published by Counterpoint. The Americans are foreigners in this story. They are referred to as the Americans rather than anything else. It's Spanish, British, Native American, and African slaves who are the focus of the book. And the Americans who come in at the end are just, they're like foreign troops invading somebody else's soil, and they're treated that way, and they're hated for what they do. But people within these groups don't necessarily treat each other very well either, do they? I'm thinking of a farmer named Pelayo and his family. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give too much away, but tell us a little bit about Pelayo and his first of all, the idea that a black man would be owning a free farm in those days is kind of amazing.
Yeah, it was, I guess, after Kao has run away from the inn and he's made it through the Mississippi Territory and he winds up in Spanish Florida, he stumbles upon the farm of a black man who's living along the Apalachicola River. And, you know, in you're right. I mean, in the novel, he's not treated well at all by this person. And I think, you know, I don't know that I was trying to make a very big statement about anything with that, other than it reminded me a little bit of the relationship in Africa that you mentioned between
the Bantu and the Pygmy.
Between the Bantus and the Pygmy, that's right. And also, you know, just because two men have the same color skin, I think history has shown, they don't automatically have some kinship or whatnot. And especially when one of them is so different in appearance as Kau is. And so, you know, I just throw characters together and see where it takes me. And that kind of felt right in that moment. You know,
well, yeah, your scholarship is to the extent that I knew anything about it, is really wonderful, and the idea that all this was plausible makes perfect sense to me because. Well, they get off on the wrong foot, in effect, because Pelayo thinks that Ko is stealing from him, which right. in fact is. He's trying to just feed himself. Mm-hmm. And so what would you do if somebody came along and started stealing from your farm in those days when things were a lot more basic and there was no law? You probably wouldn't treat them very well.
Right, right.
So, but more interestingly than – well, it's not more – but as interesting as that are the twin daughters. Tell us a little bit about these girls.
Yeah, Pelayo has two twin daughters that are kind of spooky, you know. I don't really know, and I don't think things to death, but he has two twin daughters who are actually the ones who catch Ko stealing corn from their father's field and in fact help capture him. And, you know, they play a sort of an ethereal role throughout the novel, and I guess maybe it's this duality of man type idea and how we're always sort of being pushed and pulled in different directions. And I guess anytime you see twins in a novel, you should have your ears pricked up for symbolism, right?
So. Yes. So, but there's another thing I found interesting, and I'm pretty sure it's what you wanted us to think. There's a scene in there where the girls skin rabbits. Mm. And it occurred to me that, again, this is extremely basic. I mean, we're talking about natural law, if such a thing exists, rather than laws imposed on people by wise men or, you know, sitting in some place. This is what they do to survive every day. And they're not going to be treating Ko any better than the rabbit if they, you know, if he annoys them.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
He manages to get away from them. But tell us how he gets away from them.
Yeah, well, he's kept there again. Once they capture him, they keep him as something of a curiosity. And it's funny when I wrote that scene with the farmer, I feel like I was under the influence of that Gabriel Garcia Marquez short story, The Very Old Man with Enormous Wings, because he's kept chained in the chicken house, just like the character in that short story. And I actually stole a few of the names from for these protagonists. And it was, again, this idea of how throughout their history, these indigenous pygmy tribes have been constantly underestimated and treated as curiosities. That's like sort of their fate in life, unfortunately. And so he's kept chained in this chicken house on the farm there where other runaway slaves and Native Americans come and they'll see him. And eventually what happens is the commander of this fort that the British had built, which is still in existence and it's down the river from the farm, hears about him and comes up there to see him for himself and is outraged by the way he's being treated and orders him to be freed and actually takes him with him to the fort. And that was, you know, a lot of the things that happen in novels are just, you're trying to come up with realistic things. And, you know, the origin of this novel was me learning of the fort. But then when I chose this man as my protagonist, it became pretty clear to me that he would never choose to go to that fort. He would search for a place in the forest where he could live as close as possible to what he had been stolen from.
Looking for Eden, yeah.
Right. So, you know, unlike some of the runaway slaves who definitely wanted to make a bid for this fort, I think that'd be the last thing you want. He's an outsider even among other slaves. He doesn't feel any, you know, real association with them any more than he does with the Americans. And so I wanted him to get there and I wanted him to be there. And so part of that was I think I needed to have him captured by Pelayo and then liberated by General Garcon and taken to this fort. And yeah, so a lot of it is just solving plot problems, you know.
General Garcon is, I think, what we can fairly call a complex character. Mm-hmm. Describe General Garcon for us.
Well, you know, in researching this fort, which was referred to most commonly as the Negro Fort, you know, there's accounts of a general that was in charge of it, and at certain times he would be referred to as Garcon Garson, I should say, with an S. And
the
other
Brits probably called him that,
right? And other times Garcon with the yeah. C. And then I saw a few references where it was Garcon, the French, you know, for boy. And That's when I realized that's probably the right one, you know, and it became Corrupted because that one was so unusual among those two that I was like, that's probably the correct one. And really nothing else is known for him other than his, you know, fate, which is at the end of the novel.
And there were certainly French in the area at the time.
Absolutely, yeah. And so I got to have this, you know, really interesting thing where I could create his backstory and create him completely as a character, where he is, from all, you know, all accounts, there was a person there with that name. But you don't. He has no history. I mean, like most slaves, we don't get. We're not privy to that story. It kind of dies with them.
Did anybody write? I mean, I understand that many of the slaves couldn't read and write in English or Spanish or French. But did somebody else, a contemporary historian or traveler, write histories of them? Do you know about that?
Of this fort?
Yes.
Well, the Americans, when they went down there, when the American government finally listened to these plantation owners and sent troops down there. It was done sort of on the sly because this was a Spanish country, and so they were going into a sovereign nation, which is an act of war. And so they did this and didn't really write a whole lot about it. But there are a few letters to Congress that the American commanders wrote that still exist, and they mention these. These sort of Garson's mentioned in there for sure, and the different things going on. But as far as the runaway slaves that were there, those stories really didn't get told.
Alas. Mm-hmm. There are some, I don't want to say mystical elements, because that's putting too much of mm-hmm. an emphasis on that, but there were some things which have a spiritual nature to them, and one of them is the pigeons. There's a coop of pigeons in the fort that Garcon, mm-hmm. I mean, he loves these pigeons.
Right.
In some ways, more than the people that are under his protection, but they have a specific purpose. Describe what's going on with the pigeons.
Yeah, you know, there's the fort, and the fort's located about 15 miles up the Apalachicola River from the Gulf Coast. And in reading the accounts of the fighting there and what happened, it became clear that there was also sort of an outpost at the very mouth of the river. And so just in writing the novel, the question of how did these two forts communicate with one another? And probably in history, chances are that, you know, it was through runners or messengers or horseback on trail or boat. But then I became really interested in the idea of carrier pigeons. And, that's certainly plausible as well. And flying back and forth between these forts and the honing instinct, I don't overthink these things, but there's a kinship there between, I think, all these people who have been stolen from a certain place and are searching for home that I liked. And, so I don't know. That's how they made their way in there, I suppose.
Yeah. There's an island mm-hmm. where the pigeons are kept. Mm-hmm. And any time a message needs to be sent back to the fort, they send them back to the fort until finally you get a whole cage full of pigeons, and then they have to be boated back down to the island. And this is one of the things that Cao gets to do when he's under the protection of General Garcon. And it's reminding me a little bit, this is maybe way off the deep end, but mm-hmm. if you remember in Siddhartha, the Hermann Hesse novel, where one of the things he does that makes him feel whole again was to become an apprentice to a river pilot, someone who paddles a boat back and forth across the river. That's all he does. and Siddhartha finds deep meaning just in that act, the simple act of going back and forth. And it occurs to me that while Cao is always planning his escape, this thing about the pigeons, always going back home, that seems to register with him in some way.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, that was what became a problem. I didn't know much about carrier pigeons until when I came upon the idea. And in researching them, I realized that, you know, some people think that they can go from one place to another, and they can't. They just know how to get home, and so the place they're born. So if one's born in spot X and you take it somewhere else, it'll fly back to X. But there's none of this transfer. So like you mentioned, after you run out of pigeons at the one place, you need to ship them all back down again. I think that's what I became interested in, the connection with Cao, this idea that you keep being pulled back to a certain place or just, you know, this something really inside you.
And Africa's always in his mind. He's even when he's looking for some place to go to in Florida, mm-hmm. it's just a substitute for Africa.
That's right. I mean, I think it's just he'll never obviously be able to replace what was taken from him or where he was stolen from. You know, his family back there is dead. His people are gone from forever. So he just wants to find the closest thing he can and quit, you know, quit wandering the earth. And again, it's this these pigeons type idea. You know,
This is a kind of a tangential question, but have you been back to Pensacola, that area, since the oil spill?
I actually have not. I'm from, like I said, I'm from South Louisiana and spent a lot of time in Florida, so I do have a lot of friends in that area and keep in touch with them. But if you listen to the politicians, they tell you it just disappeared. So, but yeah, no, it's in talking to people, it really does concern me. And as far as it's one of those things. I feel like it's gonna. This is nothing profound, but that it's gonna be. It's going to be causing problems for a long, long time. You know?
My brief time in Pensacola, I spent a week there on business years ago, and the only two things I remember from that are the most gorgeous natural beaches that I've seen almost anywhere, although we do pretty well on the West Coast, and the military. There's an enormous military presence in Pensacola, so you'll be sitting on this gorgeous white sand beach, and then six or seven jets go flying over your head. It's a combination of everything that Kau was looking for and the worst of what we have now.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, the Blue Angels, I believe, are stationed there.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so a lot of noise and stuff. What are you working on now?
I'm working on another novel, and it's a contemporary novel. This one, and you mentioned the oil industry has been on my mind, and the protagonist of this novel is someone who gets injured while working on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. I actually started working on it before the oil spill, but since that happened, that's also maybe renewed my energy in it and everything. So it's very voice driven. I'm just kind of letting this character, you know, see where he takes me. After writing this novel, The Eden Hunter, there was so much research involved with that I'm finding it freeing to work on something that's, you know, first person, very voice driven, contemporary, and just hang on for the ride type novel.
Well, I'm sure you learned things writing this book that'll you can put to good use in the new one. I'd like to thank you for coming in. I've been speaking with Skip Horak. His last name is spelled H-O-R-A-C-K. Title of his book is The Eden Hunter, published by Counterpoint. When your new novel comes out, come on back.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.